Welcome to the 7 Investing Podcast. I am Dan Klein, and joining me today is a pioneer in the cannabis space. Of course, the cannabis development space, not the cannabis usage space. We have to be really, really careful on this one. I'm not having Snoop Dogg on today. You're probably very tired of those level of jokes. Morgan Paxia, he is one of the founders of Poseidon Investment Management. That is one of the longest running dedicated cannabis investment funds in the world. Morgan, welcome to the 7 Investing Podcast.
Thank you for having me. It's great to be on today.
On the top, before we get into the cannabis space, which is complicated, it's a tough way to make money. Why don't you take me a little bit through the history of Poseidon and maybe some of the investments you've made, sort of how you see the space?
Sure. Emily and I, our brother-sister team, founders of Poseidon. We started the firm back in 13. We had been researching the idea of cannabis for a lot longer than that. We come from a family background that brought us to the space. There's a lot of early kind of pioneers and still people today are drawn to cannabis, is usually through some family relation that has changed perceptions around it. And so we were fortunate enough to be of a changed mindset at a young age. And so for us, when we started thinking about cannabis, talked about a lot of product ideas back in the day, a lot of different ways about approaching the industry. But after Colorado had voted to legalize, we felt that that was a change in history. Never a straight line, but it was certainly was a moment that, you know, was a permanent shift and really kicking off the beginning of the investable legal market. And I came from an investment background. Emily came from a market research background. We thought the two of our skill sets would be really interesting to solve for being first-time fund managers. At the time, there were no other funds really doing that in the space. And we just kind of felt that this was one of those moments where if we didn't do it, we would have regret for the rest of our lives. And so that's what started Poseidon. Started investing outside capital in the beginning of 2014. And now, you know, through the last several years, really almost 8 years, it's kind of amazing to think. We have numerous private funds. We have SPVs. And we're in the quiet period for our ETF that's coming out. So, you know, very active, all things cannabis. We've invested in companies, public companies, private companies, early stage, debt, real estate, whether it's plant touching or ancillary. We've really gotten super deep into cannabis and still see a lot of opportunity. We feel this is still very early days.
It is absolutely very early days. And we'll talk about that a little going forward. But just to give you a little background. So at 7 Investing, we are long-term buy and hold investors. We are looking for investments that in theory, we're going to hold forever. That's made incredibly challenging in this space with the ever-changing laws and sort of the threat of legalization. And we haven't seen anything pull back. So that's a positive. But a lot of people have gone gung-ho. And you mentioned starting an ETF and you said quiet period. So you don't have to talk about anything specific about it. But broadly, I've actually been against ETFs in the space because it tends to give you exposure to stuff you don't want to own and stuff you really, really, really don't want to own, in my opinion. How do you sort of, as an investor, not necessarily for your ETF, look at what's the noise and what's the actual winner going to be? Because there have not been a lot of winners.
Yes. Great point. And we've always believed this is an investable space. This, you know, there's certainly opportunities for traders, has been for years, and probably will continue to do so until we have a much more normalized balance of institutional ownership. Right now, institutional ownerships are still extremely low in our space on the plant touching side. Ancillary side, you see a lot more, it's still low, but you just see significantly more because there are access to the exchanges. With that said, for it to be investable, you know, Poseidon, we have a very well-established process at this point. We are opportunistic. We are dynamic. We're always evaluating the changing landscapes of cannabis. But at the end of the day, it comes down to people. That's always paramount. It's kind of like you always hear these, ideas of people, process, and price, right? And so that's kind of a similar mantra for us. I mean, it's you got to be comfortable with the management teams, have conviction around them, where they are investing, how they're allocating capital themselves, and what the entry price is. Yeah, I think that's every year as an investor, our industry gives opportunity. It's kind of amazing, you know, so it's just being mindful and not getting too caught up in the high moments. And that's unfortunately what we do see happen, right? Is, you know, you see it on Twitter, people are very upset. They've, you know, markets are down depending on what you've owned, you know, 30, 40, 50, 60%, you know, from their highs or even in just the last 3 months. You know, for us, we just have been doing this for so many years. These are great environments. There's a lot of times where I'm feeling contrarian as an investor in cannabis. And right now I've been talking a lot, you know, for when this airs, you know, we're talking in the early fall of 2021, you're seeing a lot of debt getting raised by public companies very easily. There's a lot of demand. And there's demand from maybe institutional money can play on that a little bit. The contrarian in me says when debt is really easy to sell from a company, equity is where you want to be. And it's vice versa. I mean, in February this year, there was like $1 billion raised from the public companies on the equity side. And when it's really, again, really easy to sell, that kind of tells you where you are in that cycle. So, you know, just as investors, we always say you can be patient. It's a fast growing industry. This is evolving. You know, we think there's 20 years of this, of cannabis, of opportunity. So I'll pause there for a second.
Yeah, I think it's longer than that, actually. But so, you know, you mentioned easy money, and we saw, so I live about 3 miles from a MedMen. And they built a MedMen on here in West Palm Beach, an incredibly expensive real estate, on the theory that legalization was coming. That is not a company like, say, a Trulieve that like can balance both sides of recreational and medicinal. They are a heavily recreational company. I've been to their Vegas outpost. Yeah. How do you avoid as an investor something that really looks good? Those were beautiful stores. They were, and the walls fell in really quickly there in terms of growth slowed down and all of a sudden they couldn't raise money. And a lot of people were going, hey, where's our money? How do you, as an investor, evaluate where there's growth is too quick or there's more noise than there's actually signal? It's a challenging thing for me in this space because I mentioned Trulieve before. That's a company I really love, but what happens if here in Florida we have recreational and all of a sudden they're competing with like really cool Planet 13 stores? I think they'll be fine actually, because they've done a really good job with their having low cost real estate and they'll serve the locals, not the tourists. But how as an investor do you handle that?
Poseidon, we've always been boots on the ground. We're out in the markets. COVID obviously slowed us down for a bit of time, but we're back out. We've been traveling a bunch already this year, and we'll be traveling more and more again. I mean, our team's just getting bigger, so there's just more people and more markets. MedMen was an easy one for us to say no to. It was super easy. I mean, if you were in the market at all, if you did any kind of work on the team, if you looked at their financials, there were warning signs all over, just, you know, yellow, you know, flags on the field. Just this was heading for a disaster. And, you know, they spent years now trying to right size all of those very aggressive early decisions that were just poor capital allocation. Even if legalization had gone faster, I don't think the outcome would have been much different. It was built wrong from the beginning. And so, you know, it's been super costly to right size that. They're starting to show signs of stabilization, but from an equity standpoint, it's largely worthless. It's all getting assumed by, you know, the amount of debt that they've had to put on the business to take it out. So from an enterprise value, there's very little on the equity side of that. But other teams, there's other great companies. I mean, it's no secret that Poseidon's been longtime investors and some of these companies that have now since exited or become public companies, like GTI is a great example, very strong team. I think Emily was recently quoted in Barron's, referring to them, Ben and Anthony and Andy as kind of like Warren Buffett-esque, as being, you know, just stewards of capital, really strong capital allocators, and couldn't be different from, you know, and they both became public very similar time periods. They were both, it was at in 2018 when GTI listed just about a month after MedMen, and just look at the difference of those companies in the public markets over that time period is dramatically different. Look at the amount of dilutive capital, just in every sense, stability of management, execution. so on and so on. So that's like a name that, you know, those kind of names that you can have a lot of conviction around management, you know, will ebb and flow. You know, we talk about this. I just did a blog post not too long ago on Medium. We put everything up on Medium. So if people check out Poseidon on Medium, relating cannabis to the tech bubble, and just all the similarities. And it's a great example of right now of just good quality teams managed through whether there's great public markets or weak public markets. They will continue to march forward and build enterprises.
So I worked in tech in the late 90s during the tech bubble. So I worked for a company called Uproar, which was a top 25 website. And not only was revenue sort of something that didn't matter, it actually wasn't possible. The story I always tell is Ford wanted us to change our bingo game. Bingo was very popular online back then, to Focus, when they launched the Ford Focus. And it was a $50,000 contract. And it cost us like $180,000 to do it. Obviously, the cloud changed that. There's actual revenue possible in the cannabis space. But is some of this that you have to walk rather than run, where it's like, okay, we're moving into Florida, and I live in Florida, but I travel a lot. You know, we're moving into Florida, which is medical, but there's every belief here there's going to be recreational. But do you have to sort of walk in that you build what exists, but knowing what you're going to do if the rules change, which isn't generally how you build retail or any, you know, if I open a coffee shop, I'm not worried that, like, you know, decaf's going to become illegal or not be legalized. So is it really like you have to see two steps ahead, but you have to be very protective of capital as you grow?
So cannabis, you know, still is federally illegal. And as a result, we have a state-by-state market rolling out. And so every state has its own program and their decisions of how they are, how much, is it a limited license market? Is it more of an open market scheme? And those have vast implications on price, on the price of the plant, you know, the wholesale prices, the amount of supply demand. You know, and I, right now I talk about this quite a bit is, the two major things we look at in, when looking at new markets, new states to enter, are those inputs about what is the licensing process, because that will have major implications on, is the market going to be supply balance or demand balance? You know, where is that? Because that directly feeds into the wholesale price. Florida is a big, robust market. You know, the rate of new patient growth has slowed dramatically, and there's been a lot more competition coming in. You know, it's, again, no secret that, you know, Curaleaf has said they're coming for Trulieve, and they're coming in, you know, they've got a big balance sheet and they're, you know, flexing hard, and there's others that are coming in as well. And it's becoming more of a feeling like more of an open market than it used to. And I'll remember, I never forget, was it 2016, Acreage paid $50 million for one license. And I was like, well, they just top ticked the market. And, you know, it's been just compression ever since on the licensing, you know, value side of things. Still very good market, and adult use will add to it. But I think Florida will feel very similar to like Arizona, where Arizona had a very robust medical market, and then they opened adult use. It certainly did take it up a step, but now it's kind of treading a little bit because it's just really transitioning who used to be former medical patients into the adult use market. At the end of the day, we still have a long, long way to go in any of these markets because our major competition, even for these MSOs, is not each other. It's the illicit market. And that has years and years, as you're saying, like, you know, I think 20 years, you think it's even longer, which is great to hear to me. But yeah, so that's every market, you know, we look at it very differently. And, you know, it's so true right now. If you look at pricing in states like California, Oregon, where wholesale prices are a fraction of what you see on the East Coast.
I think people are underestimating here in Florida, specifically the Orlando market. It, I think, has the potential to be another Vegas. I don't know if you've ever spent a day at Disney World with kids, but I feel like even if you are, you know, particularly straight-laced, you may be open to perhaps, you know, an edible or something. I think the market, but then I wonder a little bit about Miami, a market that it's not that hard to get whatever you want anyway. So I'm not entirely sure there's all that uptick. And we've seen this with restaurant chain after restaurant chain, and it's the mistake MedMen made here in West Palm Beach. We're not a tourism market. We're a snowbird market. Like the 75-year-old who's coming down, yeah, maybe they get like an arthritis cream or something, but you know, I've talked to my mom about cannabis because she has knee issues and she's not going out to get cannabis because there is still that stigma. Do you think some of this is just waiting until the next generation? Like, I think my son, who's 17, his generation views cannabis much the way we viewed alcohol, where it's like, yeah, it's something you can do responsibly. Obviously, he's also seen people do it irresponsibly. There's all sorts of freakouts at his school all the time. But do you think some of this is just like a wait until that older generation kind of dies off? They're probably taking it anyway. They're just poo-pooing it on the side.
The latter. Your former, that's a great way to put that, is that they're poo-pooing it, but they're doing it. because we see the data and we know that baby boomers are a very strong growth demographic in cannabis. So they might not talk about it. They may feel the stigma, so they have to say something negatively towards it. I'll tell you, more and more East Coast people I know are reaching out about their parents, are saying, hey, you know, I want to try this. Where do I go? And so I'm like almost on the regular pulling up dispensaries and checking them out for quality and saying, okay, this is a, go check this one out, go here. And they'll probably, you know, advise you to some, you know, helpful products. So I do see the stigma slowly stepping down, at least in an outward facing way. Where I think it's a really interesting point though, is about the demographics and what that will change from the legal standpoint. Because they are more willing to vote to support progress versus maybe that stigma might make the older generations feel like they shouldn't be voting. But anytime we actually get this to a vote, it's usually doing pretty well. I mean, we have Alabama's now a legal medical market. I mean, I know it's just at the very beginning, but I mean, that's Jeff Sessions' territory, who tried to shut our whole industry down not that long ago, for those that remember that, that was very real. And now it's a legal medical market. And, you know, that's why it's, I think there's a little bit longer of a duration on federal laws changing, because the elected officials in our country are very old. And they are not voting for what their constituents want, but they're voting what they think because of stigmas of the past, and or they're just political infighting like crazy. I mean, you can't do anything in this country these days because of this. We're so polarized, which is really unfortunate, because if you just get any kind of primitive banking bill in the Senate, it would pass and it would do wonderful things for our industry, and not even asking for much. We're not asking for federal laws to change outright, other than just make it legal for the banks. It would be very good for the overall benefit of our industry. It would provide more of a robust industry. Right now, in the absence of legal banking, you are enriching the largest and at the detriment of the smallest, not having a fair shake at the table. Cost of capitals couldn't be more different from the largest companies in our space to the smallest. That spreads very wide. And so they just keep getting bigger and stronger at a very fast rate.
This is part of a bigger problem. I don't know if you watched any of the tech company hearings in Congress, where you had congressmen on both sides of the aisle that talk about book face and don't understand. You know, Richard Blumenthal, who I've interviewed many times from Connecticut, talking about Facebook shutting down Finsta, which is, of course, a fake Instagram account. I really don't think...
Shut it down.
Yeah, I don't think any of these people are going to be capable. And I've talked a lot about in technology that the technology companies should be banding together and forming like an OSHA-like body that sets their own regulations, because I grew up in the construction industry, and who better than the construction industry? But obviously, this is a state-by-state basis. So aside from banking laws, which I think have a reasonable possibility to pass before the midterms, I don't think it's crazy to think that we could see that. But are you concerned that, given the current tax state, where a lot of municipalities needed money, they really all went for sports betting, and not that many of them went for, like, I thought here in Florida, no question, we would get full legalization, recreational legalization. And instead we got a sports betting bill, because I think the average person of a certain age, and I don't want to, I know plenty of super hip of a certain age people who are very progressive on this, not progressive in the political sense, in the actual meaning of the word. I'm always so afraid of angering people by being political. But is this an area where like sports betting is kind of taking some of that, hey, we'll produce new tax revenue thunder, and there just needs to be more education done to make this less stigmatized?
So tax revenues have been quite robust. Illinois actually collects more in cannabis revenue in 2021 than they do in alcohol tax revenues. Our tax rates are too high. So that's part of why it is the case. Again, it's more easily afforded in markets where there's very high wholesale prices, but it's at the consumer's expense. Here in California, we have a completely absurd tax and regulatory scheme such that it's actually hurting the market. And you have municipalities that have put moratoriums on dispensaries in their jurisdictions at the consequence of getting access to those tax revenues. So you're right. I mean, it is interesting how decisions are made. Because we do generate incredible amount of jobs. If we were in the ADP report, I mean, it'd be amazing to see what the labor statistics would be like in this country, but they won't include us because we're cannabis. And, we have this pesky federal issue called 280E, which was a tax code that was created, I think, in the 80s because of a very successful cocaine business. Where they were taking standard business deductions, and the IRS said, wait a minute, this is you're an illegal business. You can't have standard deductions, which was their way of solving. So, you know, they collect significant tax revenues at the federal level from cannabis. It's incredible. I mean, I always say the IRS is the largest cannabis bank in the world. They have no problem taking cash. There's a lot of growing up for sure that our industry needs to do, and it's proving it for sure. The longer we operate, the longer that there's more data saying that, you know, from a safety of consumers, from the benefits that or there's not the concerns that everyone was saying, like we're going to become a zombie apocalypse, all this stuff. It's not happening, right? And that's it plays out over time. But again, until the stigma goes away. And what would you guess the average age of the elected officials in our country is today?
Oh, it's got to be over 60.
Yeah. And rising rapidly, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So one of the things I look for when I evaluate a company in this space is legislative experience. Like, I want to see them have executives that have been mayors, been congressmen, it doesn't have to be that high a level, but have experience negotiating with that. Is that something you look at?
It's an interesting point. It is very important to be able to negotiate or to be able to represent your company properly so that you're able to win licenses in competitive markets. It is a high value thing to do. But then otherwise, we're looking for people that are just good capital allocators, good operators, good at manufacturing, good at running retail, good at agriculture. You know, these are, if you're on the plant touching side, it's pretty complex businesses, break it into its individual pieces and, good execution in those pieces. And then on the ancillary side, they're just ancillary companies like anything else. So I think it's probably helpful from an advisory function more so, because there could be help around, understanding who the folks are in certain areas and whether or not that is going to be a good place to try to do business or not. We're just believers that capital flows to where it's treated best. And, if you have elected officials that are just unwilling, capital will retreat. California is a great example. We're seeing, we talked about a few years ago was going to be like a mass extinction event. And we're seeing it now. There's a lot of companies failing here and growths have slowed. And you look at how different that is on the East Coast where growth rates are still just climbing strongly. California and Canada have a lot of parallels, completely oversupplied, not enough access on the demand side. And prices are falling as a result, and companies are failing as a result. That's why you see all the Canadian LPs that were once the darlings of our industry because they were New York or NASDAQ traded are finally seeing their share prices fall to, and they're still expensive relative to the US companies that have positive growth rates of 50, 75% annualized with gross margins, 40s, 50s, 60s in some instances, and strong EBITDA margins. What kind of businesses can you buy elsewhere that have that kind of fundamental metrics and you're paying what, 5x 21 sales and like 3x 22 sales on a median basis? And you're paying, I think we're down under 10 times EV to EBITDA on 22. I mean, we're rapidly getting to 22. I mean, we're trading like a private equity industry in a public market. We talk about this too, as where, right now the valuation curve has inverted, where late stage private companies are trading richer than public companies in our space. That's a consequence of the markets coming down more quickly. Public markets move obviously faster than privates. For us, we just think it's, just another one of these instances. If you're an investor and you're thinking longer than a minute, if you're thinking 3-5+ years, certainly looks really interesting to us as investors. But again, we're investors and we think this is my life stake. I'm 99% invested in Poseidon. So I'm all in on where we're heading as an industry and just believe there's a lot more to come.
Do you think there's any chance we backtrack legally in the US?
I can't say no because it still is federally illegal. So sure, but at what cost would that be? I mean, I know we throw trillions around like it's nothing these days. So I guess, maybe that is, I should be, so it's not a zero probability. I'll put it that way. I just, that would certainly be a black swan event of our time. And so, as more mainstream industries are becoming more entrenched in this too, CPG businesses want in, alcohol, tobacco, they're all seeing either negative growth or very low growth. And here we are as an industry, I think we're growing, 40% year over year this year in the United States alone. It's a $24 billion industry heading to $30 billion next year. And it's continuing on. It's going to be a very large part of our economy. So, and there's something like 350,000 jobs in cannabis this year in the US alone. So you would shutter a lot of employment, you'd shutter a lot of tax revenue. So I think it's hard to say this, like when Jeff Sessions, I mentioned earlier, had, tried to shut the industry down, there was a higher probability and that was scary. At this point, it would be, I don't know what politician would do that, would want to push something forward like that, because they like to get reelected, right? They're in the business of getting reelected. And I just don't see, when you have something like, almost 70% of Americans believe in legalization. Over 70% of Americans already live in some form of a legal market. That would be borderline political suicide to try to do something like that. So I feel like there's, again, it's not a zero probability, but it's getting harder and harder to imagine.
Yeah, I think it's relatively close to a zero probability. It's almost become like prohibition, like something that, you might see a state roll something back because regimes change, but I actually think it's more likely that you see, significant more legalization. Let's ask a final question here. Is cannabis a threat to alcohol? Because I look at it and I say, okay, there's a lot of people, dying of alcoholism and other things. And it's not that there aren't dangers with cannabis, but there might be some people who make some switches. Like, ultimately, and generationally, certainly, I think younger people are maybe more likely to be exposed to cannabis because, hey, when you and I were in high school, it wasn't just all that easy to come by, and it wasn't good if you could get it. But do you think we could see a little bit of a shift in, let's call it, the recreational responsible market?
Early on, Boston Beer Company, Sam Adams, used to have in their financial statements a risk disclosure about cannabis. They've taken that disclosure away. And to me, and they're actually doing some things on the cannabis side. So we're You know, early on, it was more of a risk that they would try to shut it down. Same thing with tobacco. We're seeing it more as they're partnering. They want to get in. They want to be a part of it. Again, they have massive amounts of invested infrastructure. It is in their best interest to keep that infrastructure moving and operating as efficiently and as at capacity as it can, right, for generating returns. And we can bring in added capacity that could be of interest to them when federal laws change. So I certainly think they are trying to position, they're getting smart on it. It is a CPG category. I think this is why there's a lot of interest in beverage, more so from a curiosity standpoint than it is necessarily as a consumption point in cannabis. It still is a very small category. If you go to Headset data and look at consumption trends, beverage is a small percentage. But it's growing. It's growing rapidly. Technology is getting better. The flavor profiles are getting better. The effects are getting better. And as that becomes more normalized to a social consumption kind of experience, I can only see alcohol becoming more and more interested in doing so and becoming involved in it. And there's been numerous, right? I mean, Molson Coors, Lagunitas, Boston Beer, who else? I mean, there's more than I can even think of off the top of my head that are, I mean, Constellation Brands, obviously that's no secret at this point if you're in the industry and, what they've tried to do with Canopy. Don't think that's been what they were hoping it would turn out to be, but they're not turning away from the category. I think they just realize they may have bet on the wrong situation to accomplish that. But I think there's a lot of ways we can work together. I think it's interesting. I think it's kind of funny that people today eat a gummy as a form of consumption. Like who eats one gummy of anything, right? Unless it's a vitamin or, a mineral or, like a daily mineral, but otherwise, that's not a social experience.
So here's the thing. I don't buy gummy bear vitamins because I like gummy bears and I'm always worried that I'm just going to someday like eat 10,000 milligrams of vitamin C. Like I've never understood, and I've toured many of the Vegas cannabis dispensaries. I've never understood the chocolate bar where like a serving is one square. Who eats one square of chocolate? And at some point, are you just going to be like sleepy and, I sleepwalk. So I'm eating in my sleep. I don't want to accidentally eat 15 servings of chocolate bar. It seems to me like it would be more like the alcohol infused gummies, which is actually something you could buy at a pretty cool candy bar in Vegas where you get like 30 of them and it's all together one drink. That seems like stuff the industry can work out in the long term, right?
Yes. Yep. Step one has been getting access. Step two has been, form factors that are approachable. And then, so on and so on, we will be getting deeper and smarter and more approachable to a broader and broader audience, and doing a better job of penetrating the illicit market because we're creating more of a normalized experience. So that's what excites me is like, we are just at the tip of this spear and we've already generated an industry of $24 billion in sales in the United States this year alone. And we're still just scratching the surface. So I really will be, amazed to look back on this another 10 years and see what's happened.
Morgan Praxia, consider it a date. We will meet again in 10 years. Now, we will do this much before that. Thank you for joining the 7 Investing Podcast.
Thank you for having me.
A reminder that people on this program may hold positions in the companies that are mentioned. Buying and selling stock carries financial risk, which could include the loss of capital. The views in this program should not be taken as personalized advice. Before acting on any of the information provided, listeners are encouraged to consult a financial or tax professional.